TPR tells the stories of our city, our struggles and our triumphs. Leaving a legacy gift to Texas Public Radio helps keep those stories alive. Find out how to create your legacy at tpr.org/legacy.
Welcome to Fronteras, a program that explores issues at the border and beyond through the lens of arts, culture, and history. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Operation Paperclip was a secret post-World War II program by the U.S. to gain the expertise of German and Austrian engineers and scientists who crafted one of the deadliest weapons of the war, the V-2 missile. Over 100 of these scientists were brought to far west Texas, and most of them, though they and the U.S. Army would deny it, were active Nazis, including the head of the V-2 program, Wernher von Braun. Their most notable achievements were making the U.S. a contender in the space race and a stalwart against the Soviet Union in the Cold War. What's less known about the group of Nazi scientists is the families that followed them to the El Paso desert and the Nazi children who attended El Paso public schools. Jonna Perillo wrote about these paperclip families in her 2022 book, Educating the Enemy, Teaching Nazis and Mexicans in the Cold War Borderlands. The title implies that the Nazis weren't the only enemies to the so-called American way of life. Mexicans were too. Ethnic Mexican children in El Paso and elsewhere across Texas borderlands were taught in segregated schools at the time. Mexican and Mexican-American students were seen, often by the teachers themselves, as low-achieving or less capable of being good Americans. Perillo says the young German paperclip children who had less of a grasp on the English language experienced, on the contrary, an immediate assimilation into classrooms that were predominantly made up of white children.
The El Paso public school system was over 60% Mexican and Mexican-American children at the time, though you wouldn't know it looking at class pictures from where the schools where the paperclip children ended up. As you said, they were highly segregated. And I'm really interested in both the sort of policies that created that and then the very different kinds of curricular developments that each of the groups of children experienced in school. And as you said, one big piece of that is language education. So like the paperclip children, the majority of Mexican-American children came to school in El Paso speaking often very little English, sometimes none, definitely Spanish dominant. But unlike the paperclip children, Mexican-American children really, this was seen as a behavioral problem, right? Not just a sort of academic challenge, but something that said a great deal about them as citizens or not. And so corporal punishment was, you know, very common in schools in South El Paso, where the great majority of Mexican-American students attended. Even now, when I give talks on the book, it's very common for someone in the audience to speak up about this, about their memories of attending school where they could be beaten for speaking Spanish in school, including on the playground, or assigned demerits, or just otherwise punished, and being taught that speaking Spanish was actually un-American. They received this message in a number of different ways, Mexican-American children, that they were not American, but language was just one of the most obvious examples. By contrast, the paperclip children, who also spoke no English and whose parents often, their mothers in particular, spoke very little to no English, were taught English quite differently. They were given ice cream or other prizes for not speaking German, so a kind of carrot sort of approach to language education versus the stick that Mexican-American children faced in school.
And also what I thought was really interesting that you pointed out in this book, that the education system at the time was meant as a way to democratize the children, to teach them about
American democracy and the fact that the young German children, they were always very clean and very eager to learn, whereas the young Mexican children, they were often seen as unclean or lazy or unwilling to learn and therefore maybe not being deserving of citizenship or a place in democracy or as a contributor to society.
Not deserving and not really wanting it. So one of the things that was very helpful to me in writing this book is that the local press in El Paso, and to some degree the national press too, went to work at showing these paperclip children in school. So it was supposed to be a covert operation, but that was very hard to maintain once the family showed up. And the children in particular, the German children, were leaving base every day at a time when their parents were not even allowed to. So they were really the face of the operation to the American public. And this was covered pretty widely in the El Paso press in particular. And there was this real effort by the press. I think it was a connection in some ways between the press, the military, and American public schools to tell this story of the children's quick assimilation, the German students' quick assimilation. And as you said, this had something to do with how they looked. They looked like white Americans wanted to imagine themselves, not just in terms of their physical appearance, like their phenotype, but also in terms of their affordance. They were middle-class children, well-dressed, highly disciplined. They came from school cultures in which discipline was a serious business. So the press covered this and really portrayed them as ideal Americans in the making. And that was important both to justify Operation Paperclip, but it also told a story about schooling and assimilation and social citizenship that was really at the heart of public education as a project and was the kind of story that American schools wanted to tell about themselves. So if Mexican-American children looked different or were often projected as antisocial, as undisciplined, as diffident and socially uncomfortable, this was on them, not on, you know, what they encountered when they went to schools.
Well, another, I think, really interesting point that you brought up in the book, that the paperclip families weren't necessarily considered immigrants. Again, it was kind of a secret program, and they were kind of these invisible residents to the government. And so what was, I thought, fascinating is that this was a group of individuals who had a path open to them for legal citizenship. Can you tell us sort of the way that the government was able to offer the paperclip families the citizenship? And they did that, I think, by taking them into Mexico and then bringing them back into the United States, correct?
Yeah, well, what happened is the families came over by ship and arrived in New York and took a train to New York and were just never recorded. And this was really surprising. I interviewed about 20 former paperclip children to write the book, and this was surprising to them. They didn't realize that they were what one of them called, I think, invisible aliens. It was only when the entire project was moved to Huntsville, Alabama, within a couple of years, and they were moved there to build NASA eventually, that they were, as you said, brought over the border to Juarez, to the consulate, and re-entered the United States at that point with paperwork. But the entire group was given American citizenship in 1955. This was, you know, as a thank you, really, for their service in a lot of ways. So they had been in the country for less than a decade at that point.
And you also draw the comparison is that, you know, these were paperclip families that were offered legal citizenship, whereas Mexican Americans who are already U.S. citizens, they were seen, as you called, eternal aliens.
Yes. The great majority of the students that were in El Paso schools were American born and were absolutely citizens. They just weren't treated like that.
Well, another interesting, I know this is kind of a little bit off kilter, but you brought it up in the book, and I thought it was really interesting that you wouldn't think that there would be a link between Nazis, Germans in the United States, and Mexican Americans, but there was a point in history where the workers who would cross the border from Mexico into the United States, they would be deloused. And one of the chemicals that was used for that was Zyklon B. And that is a chemical that was used by the Nazis in their extermination of Jews in concentration camps.
Yeah, there's that connection, which I think people are more familiar with thanks to David Romo's work in Ringside to a Revolution, which is very well-read here in El Paso. But there were other connections, too. The Nazi legal system and the Nuremberg laws, in fact, were built on Jim Crow. And so while there was a difference between American failures of democracy and Nazi fascist ideology, really the whole entire legal system was based on something that American lawyers had developed and that Nazis looked to as a way of legalizing or implementing, you know, their own racist ideologies.
Has that ever been written about at length? Because I don't think I've ever really made that connection until I read about it in your book.
It has been written about, actually. A legal historian named James Whitman has a really excellent book called Hitler's American Model that accounts for the ways in which Nazis turned to Jim Crow laws as an example for their own legal system. There was a difference between failures in American democracy and Nazi fascist ideology, but they saw that Americans had crafted a legal system for instituting racist beliefs and power. And they leaned on that heavily.
Jonna Perillo is a professor of English education at the University of Texas at El Paso Department of English. She's the author of Educating the Enemy, Teaching Nazis and Mexicans in the Cold War Borderlands. We'll continue our conversation next on Fronteras.
Support for this podcast of Fronteras comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Nearly 150 children were schooled in El Paso when their families were brought from Nazi Germany after World War II to build up the U.S. Army's missile program as part of Operation Paperclip. Despite being the children of Nazi scientists, they were welcomed into the classroom and revered by the press. These children were also being used by the U.S. military as an experiment in democratization. Democratize the children, denazify the parents. The children attended Crockett Elementary, named after David Crockett, the hero of the Alamo. Crockett and other Western heroes were used in the classroom as models of patriotism and civilization in civics lessons. It was a white-centric educational tool. Crockett was the hero. Santa Anna and the Mexicans were the enemy. Mexicans in history were the objects of conquest, and that was reflected in the educational erasure of Mexican and indigenous contributions to history. Jonna Perillo has written about the disparities in education between the Operation Paperclip children and the ethnic Mexican children who attended segregated schools in El Paso at the time. It's detailed in the book Educating the Enemy, Teaching Nazis and Mexicans in the Cold War Borderlands. Perillo explains some of the parallels she has seen in researching the systems that educated the paperclip children and the system that educates today's Texas students.
To back up and talk about the historical story, public schools are places where state power and cultural power converge. And by state power, I don't just mean federal power, though that's often what we're talking about now, but even local policy. So Jim Crow didn't have anything to say about Mexican-American students, right? That was just about African-American students. In its place, a lot of localities, including El Paso, created other kinds of policies to segregate their schools. And one of the most startling findings to me when I was researching this book was uncovering this transfer policy that I think was probably quite common, but it's often hard to document, that said that students in South El Paso could only attend schools north of the railroad, the railway line, which was the division, if they were white. And vice versa, students who lived in El Paso could only transfer into South El Paso schools if they are Mexican American. So this is effectively doing that kind of work in a lot of ways. And that kind of organization of space and policing of boundaries gets echoed in the curriculum through the example that you were talking about with like cowboys and civics education and what that taught white students about entitlement and their own identity and centrality to the story of Manifest Destiny. I just offer that example to say that a lot of things are happening in schools right now. Some about federal power or state power, and we can look at the dismantling of the Department of Education and the threats that Title I schools were not going to receive funding this year, which affects El Pasoans deeply. There are a large number of students in El Paso who attend schools that are dependent on federal funding. But that those cultural narratives, I think, continue to work in public schools as well. And that the curricular decisions that entitled schools, wealthy schools, often white schools face, and those that economically disadvantaged schools face, where, you know, students of color are more likely to attend, are pretty radically different. So one way that we see this is the use of scripted curricula and just the centrality of testing, standardized testing in American education right now. The fact is, if you go to an economically disadvantaged school and a school with a high proportion of racial minorities, those students are more likely to face pressure towards testing and curricula that is really focused on test prep rather than a sort of broader, more humanistic project.
Well, you mentioned that it took many years to write this book. You mentioned this in the epilogue. You say that the U.S. has devolved into what the Germans have called the American catastrophe. And you draw those symmetries between what's happening now, what was going on in the Cold War. There's white supremacy, there's suppression of poor communities still intact. But you write, when this book was published in 2022, and I'm sure you wrote this probably in the year or two before it was published, you write that the U.S. is still no fascist state. Do you have different thoughts about that now?
Well, I'm not a political scientist. I am persuaded by the arguments that we are in a failing democracy more than an authoritarian state at the moment or a fascist state at the moment. It took me a long time to write this book, but I did a lot of the writing during the first Trump administration. And I think that that epilogue was really reflective of where we were at when I was finishing the book. And now things feel even worse in a lot of ways, right? Like that even more out of control, even more dangerous. And that's absolutely true for immigrants or people who look like immigrants, that they are under attack and more vulnerable than they were even in the first administration. But I think so too are schools. And as I mentioned, the dismantling of the Department of Education is just one example of that, right? That we have over the last 40 years really developed a school system that is more dependent on federal dollars than it was before. And a lot of that has to do with testing, with race to the top, the way in which we have connected federal dollars to certain kinds of school achievement. And those are the kinds of schools that students in El Paso attend. And so we see them really under attack, uncertain. We don't know, you know, what the long-term trajectory of them are. So, yeah, I think it's hard to know. It feels like the situation is changing so quickly that it's hard to make declarative statements about much of anything other than things don't look great.
Is there anything that you want listeners to take from reading this book? Is there sort of some underlying message that you'd like to have them walk away with, maybe something to have them ponder while they're reading this book?
Well, even though this book is really critical of schools and of the kind of work that they did, there are a couple of highlights in it. One is the work that Mexican-American parents did in the face of this kind of discrimination. They weren't just passive about it. They organized around it, and a lot of those campaigns were successful. So schools are worth fighting for. I think public schools are the most important public institution that we have in this country. They do work with our youngest and most impressionable citizens. And that's at the core of who we are as a people. So I would want people to take away that we should continue to fight for them. We need to know what's going on in schools. I think too few people really do, even if they have children attending schools. It's hard sometimes to get the kind of information about them that we would like to have. So I just encourage people to be alert and to engage themselves in whatever ways they can in, you know, school board meetings, in their own schools that perhaps they are connected to, but that at a time when, you know, we're seeing an increase in vouchers and in charter schools, we have to fight for these public institutions more than we ever have in the past.
Jonna Perillo is a professor of English education at the University of Texas at El Paso Department of English. She's the author of Educating the Enemy, Teaching Nazis and Mexicans in the Cold War Borderlands. See some images from the book at tpr.org. You've been listening to Fronteras. Fronteras editors are Dan Katz and Yvette Benavides. Chiranga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Hear past episodes at tpr.org and on the Fronteras podcast. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Thanks for listening.